from the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Hope you're having a great morning. It's going to get a little bit better, hopefully, with our show. Alan West is standing by. Dr. Todd Rose will be with us, a co-founder and president of Populous, a think tank dedicated to building a world where all people have a chance to be fulfilled in their life's work. So it also tells us what you guys care about, separate from politics. And I think it's really important. He's always a great guest. He'll be with us, too. And, of course, today, the UN Day, if you are in New York City on the East Side, you basically should walk everywhere. You're not going to be able to get anywhere. 140 world leaders are here. Prime ministers, presidents, dictators, monarchs, whatever. And a lot of protesters, too. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
We have to escalate against Hezbollah. We have to let Hezbollah know on no uncertain terms that if you're going to try to shell and displace and kill Israelis, you're going to pay a very, very painful price.
That is Michael Oren, former ambassador, Israeli ambassador to the United States, with me this morning. Middle East in flames as Israel picks up the bombing pace, and the Lebanese population are moving north away from the bombing because the prime minister personally warned them Israel wants to severely degrade Hezbollah and get Israel's back in their Israelis back in their homes who have been displaced for almost a complete year.
Number two.
I see him also as sort of a poor man's James Bond, you know, from Ukraine with love would be his movie. And also why the DOJ and FBI put those words in that particular affidavit today, I don't understand either. That makes no sense to me.
James Fitzgerald, an investigator, talking about the assassination investigation. It continues, but losing confidence in the Trump world because he wants Florida just to do it because he does not believe the FBI and the Department of Justice want justice. Meanwhile, the second assassin is in court. It becomes abundantly clear that this was not his first visit to Mar-a-Lago.
Number one.
Here, it's going to go down a little bit. It just went down $100.
Thank you so much.
We'll do that for you from the White House, all right?
Thank you.
All right, bye. Nice seeing you, everybody.
They have the President of the United States in Pennsylvania helping out at the register. A wife of and a parent of three who had a $200 bill. The president took out $100 and helped with that bill. 6 weeks until Election Day, both candidates in battleground states, with the former president giving major economic address in Georgia today. He wants to bring manufacturing back. And get this, he's got a plan. Harris gets alarming polls in the Southeast and how the VP nominee is preparing for the October 1st clash, which will be, of course, Tim Walz against J.D. Vance. So let's talk about what the president is going to be today. He's going to be in Savannah, Georgia. Vance is going to hold public events. He's going to be studying for the debate. I don't think he needs much studying. He's pretty good at combative politics. Harris is in Washington, D.C., meeting with a Qatari official. And Walz is in St. Paul, Minnesota. I believe he calls that home. So the president of the United States came out yesterday and said, look, he's got to come out today and make it official. But he wanted to relay to a small town in Pennsylvania that I got your back. I understand we got to cut your expenses and let you keep more of your money. Cut to.
We will have no tax on tips. That was an easy one. We will have no tax on overtime. You work overtime. And for our seniors who have been decimated by the stupidity of inflation, these people, what they did to you on inflation, we will have no tax on Social Security benefits.
Huge crowd. What I tell you on Wednesday, huge crowd. He's going to go to the Georgia-Alabama game on Saturday. Most of the 85,000 will be cheering for him. I know people keep saying, well, his approval rating's around 36%. No, it isn't. He's getting about 47% of the vote, and I believe right now things are trending his direction in Pennsylvania. Just to review, I went this yesterday as we came on the show. The New York Times Siena poll has the president up in North Carolina, Georgia, and Arizona. I mean, they were trending away from him. North Carolina is going to be a little bit harder because of the Republican nominee for governor. I get it. And, of course, a lot of people moving from New York to North Carolina, changing the complexion of it subtly. but I still think the president's going to win there. It could come down to Pennsylvania. And the president's got some more good news when it comes to Pennsylvania, and virtually a dead heat. But if you look in 2016, they asked people, you know, they looked at registered voters. How many more registered Democrats than Republicans? He won it in 2016, but there were 892,000 more Democrats registered than Republicans. In 2020, that number was down to 666,000. He lost it. Now it's down to 338,000. It's going to be a harder push now for the vice president, especially if people look at the track record over the last 4 years and how anemic she was thought of up until she got the nomination. Her approval rating was 32%, and I don't know where those 32% were. For Trump, he knows exactly what he's going to do. He's got to link her to the administration. That shouldn't be a reach. She is the vice president. Cut one.
Kamala Harris is reportedly giving a speech in Pittsburgh. You know, her speeches are very short. About her plan to, quote, build wealth. She doesn't know anything about building wealth. She happens to be a person that's destroyed everything she's ever touched. Kamala's ruinous economic policies have already cost the typical household $29,000 through rampant inflation. $29,000 per household. She's a one-woman economic wrecking ball.
So we'll see where this goes. The president in Georgia for the first time since August 3rd, I think. He's got to get back there more. Brian Kemp holding out Dave McCormick in Pennsylvania, the two-term very popular governor from Georgia, has also unleashed his ground game for President Trump. And word is, he means it. In the beginning, they had so much friction. I'm sure it still exists to a degree, but they decided that a Kamala Harris presidency has got to overcome any personal problems they had in 2020, and that's no joke. So I think that that's pretty clear. The other thing about the assassination investigation we'll get to, but just staying with the economy for a second, on almost every metric they were doing better. The country was doing better economically, even with the pandemic, under Trump than they were under Harris. Harris's parry is, I was taking over a mess. But that doesn't stand. Her actions of adding $7 trillion of spending had everything to do with why inflation's so high. Listen to Ian Sams. He was defending everybody against Joe Biden, all attackers. Good talker, telling everyone Joe Biden's 100%. Now all of a sudden we're supposed to buy that he's for Kamala Harris. But I got to give Pamela Brown credit of CNN. Listen to this, cut eight.
Harris was asked recently on the debate stage whether she thinks Americans are better off now than 4 years ago, and she didn't directly answer that question. So I'll ask you, does she think Americans are better off now or not?
Well, I think that she talked pretty openly about the mess that we inherited when President Trump left office and the economy and the crash that happened because of his total mismanagement of COVID and the way that COVID itself created global inflation numbers that were out of control. And so she thinks that the American people have made progress, but that we have to go even further. That's why she has. And
but,
so
but
when
I'm just going to follow up on the question
when
again.
It comes to high prices for people, the choice in the election is also very clear. And she's going to keep talking about her plans to bring down those grocery costs while Donald Trump is going to explode them.
Now, ask the question again. Are Americans, does she think Americans are better off now than 4 years ago?
Well, I think when people are running for president, they want to see, what are you going to do for me?
The answer is no. And you can blame the pandemic all you want, but you had a million shots in arms. Operation Warp Speed gave you a vaccine. You stupidly mandated it and created so much anger in the country. And number two is you kept schools closed. But you don't want to talk about the pandemic. I get it. But you can't pretend like this economy's better. You had inflation at 9%. The whole globe did not have it. It took forever to come down. Now that it's coming down, the original spike of 9% has not decreased. That's why the president says, I'm going to get food costs down, not just lessen inflation. So I'm going to take a time out, talk about the border with Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. Talk about what's happening in the Middle East with a guy that spent over two decades in the military. Now we got another 40,000 American members of our military heading to the Middle East because of what's happening with Israel, getting attacked from almost every side. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Breaking tonight, the Harris campaign is considering a last-minute trip to the border. On Friday, during her trip to Arizona, she's hoping to change the narrative that she's soft on immigration. A new poll shows that more than half of Americans believe that Trump would be better on the issue. One of the things about this moment, I mean, the Harris campaign has just been trying to kind of float above it all, to float above the immigration arguments, float above some of the nitty-gritty details on some of this policy. But this shows that they realize they have to do something.
Yeah, it does. They got to go to Arizona and then show she's tough on the border. Nobody believes that. And we know how terrible she was as a border czar. She was the laughingstock of anyone that cared about immigration. But now they want to say, well, she prosecuted transnational gangs, which, by the way, I looked up. She did 2012 and 2014. I just checked the calendar. That was 10 years ago. What did you do as senator? What did you do as vice president? It must drive a guy like Alan West crazy, who ran for governor, former Florida congressman, now head of the Dallas County Republican Party and chairman of a lot of important things. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, welcome back. Your thoughts about her trying to rehab her image on Friday going to the border.
Well, Brian, it's good to be with you. And it reminds me of that song by Janet Jackson, What Have You Done For Me Lately? We don't need to go back and talk about something that happened 10 years ago. And now for her to want to go down and say, hey, look, you know, the border means a lot to me. That's, 10 to 15 million illegal immigrants too late. And if you want to talk about prosecuting, you know, violent transnational gangs, I haven't heard her mention the Trinidad-Aragua gang that is operating freely in Aurora, Colorado, here in Dallas, Texas, and also in Chicago. That's a
result. And New York.
And New York. That's a result of her failed policies. You know, she went down there and told us that the border crisis was all about climate change, bad weather. I don't think the weather's that bad in Tajikistan where we have all these terrorists come across our border.
No, there isn't. So I got to let you hear something else. You know, famously, she was against deportation. She was for basically an open border when she was running for president. Not only that, we found tape of her. Now, you guys can't see this at home, but listen, just picture her dancing 2018 as a sitting senator to this chant. Cut 31.
Up, up with education, down, down with deportation. Up, up with education, down, down with deportation.
So she's doing that over and over again, dancing, having a great time. So down, up with education, down with deportation. And sure enough, during her reign as vice president, the deportations were down 67%. And crossings are up over 300%. So we're supposed to just shelve that and think about a new policy that she has not even qualified or explained.
Yeah, and think about this. What you just played, this clip of her, that was 2018. That was right before she ran for president. So that's more recent than her, quote-unquote, prosecutions of transnational criminal criminals. And the other thing you have to start considering here is the fact that, you know, Kamala Harris has not been engaged on this issue. She has not been engaged with the illegal immigrant crisis that we see. We have not heard her talk about the drug trafficking crisis, the human and sex trafficking crisis, the terrorist trafficking crisis that we are facing here in the United States of America. And I think the other thing we have to remember is what she said to Dana Bash was that my values haven't changed. So obviously, this is the exact same person who once said, you know, we've got to look at reevaluating ICE, you know, who is the one in charge, the agency in charge of deportations. So she is a wolf in sheep's clothing, and I think that people are realizing that, and her campaign realizes it mostly.
So I want you to hear this debate between Bret Stephens, a conservative columnist who hates Trump, and Stephanie Ruhle, who just hates Trump, from MSNBC. They're on with Bill Maher. Cut 16.
Kamala Harris is not running for perfect. We have two choices. And so there are some things you might not know her answer to.
I don't think it's a lot to ask her to sit down for a real interview as opposed to a puff piece in which she describes, like, her feelings of growing up in Oakland with nice lawns.
Then I would just say to that, when you move to Nirvana, give me your real estate broker's number and I'll be your next door neighbor. We don't live there.
I mean, he's saying, why can't you sit for an interview? So what? So what? It's not Donald Trump. I think that Stephanie Ruhle, sadly, speaks to a lot of people out there. What are your thoughts?
No, you're absolutely right. This is an example of someone in the media that is saying, I just hate Trump. I don't care what disaster may be coming to our country. And there's a different standard. You know, our candidate does not have to answer any questions because we hate the other person so bad. Our candidate is not responsible, is not accountable for the policies of these past 3.5, almost 4 years of an administration in which he's engaged and involved with. Our candidate does not have to answer any questions about, you know, who's in charge of this country right now. Jill Biden's running cabinet meetings. Where's Kamala Harris? She's the vice president. Shouldn't she be running cabinet meetings? So this shows the abject delusion of the left, and also a dangerous mentality that says they want to win, you know, by any means necessary, and the cost does not matter.
I guess so. Right now, how do you explain the decrease in border crossings?
I think the decrease in border crossings, and, you know, you talk to people here in Texas, is because right now the gangs are fighting each other. They're fighting each other for this lucrative business that they know is happening, and they're just saying, hey, if we get Kamala Harris in there, the business is going to be real good. As a matter of fact, we just had, I think, 10 to 12 bodies that were recovered near a border town on the Mexican side. Some of those bodies have been decapitated. So they're having a fight in and amongst themselves, and I think that slowed it down. But the bottom line is that they're looking for territorial gain.
I want you to hear Michael Oren was on with me today, the former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., about what's going on with Hezbollah. Cut 25.
There was an administration official, unnamed, quoted in the Israeli press today, saying he could not remember a time in history where escalating led to de-escalation. You have to de-escalate in order to escalate. Well, we strongly disagree. In fact, throughout history, the greatest example is that if you want to de-escalate, you have to escalate. That's how America won World War II. We have to escalate against Hezbollah. We have to let Hezbollah know, and on no uncertain terms, that if you're going to try to shell and displace and kill Israelis, you're going to pay a very, very painful price.
So where do you stand? Is sometimes you have to escalate to de-escalate?
Yeah, because as Ronald Reagan said, you have to have peace through strength. And these groups, Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the Houthis, all supported by Iran, they are non-state, non-uniform belligerents on the battlefield. They are terrorists, and the only way you deal with terrorists is with strength and might. You let them know that we're not going to allow you to exist. And this Biden administration policy is the reason why we have seen this. And furthermore, they have increased the coffers of Iran so that Iran can pay for these terrorist organizations to do exactly what they're doing.
So right now we have the Hezbollah higher-ups. I think Israel has wiped out about 11 of the ones closest to Nasrallah. One remains. Do you think this group can be wiped out?
Yeah, I think you do. I think you have to prosecute that case, and I think it would be good to have Donald Trump back in office to back Israel in prosecuting that case and get back to the Abraham Accords so we can have true peace in the Middle East.
That would be a nice change. Alan West, thank you. Dr. Todd Rose next. Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, I think there's this collective sense of relief among a lot of people that there's an alternative to Donald Trump and Joe Biden, and she's performed pretty well for a lot of folks up until now. I think we're going to start to see that change because she did really well when she first announced. She did really well at the debate. I think that Oprah interview is going to hurt her. I think the fact that she's not doing interviews is really hurting her. And when I talk to undecided voters, they have one major concern, and that is they feel that the economy is bad. They feel like the country's going in the wrong direction. Two-thirds of Americans right now think the country is going in the wrong direction, and it is going in her direction. She is on the masthead right now. She's the vice president. She's talking about turning the page. People want to know, how are you turning the page right when it's your page?
Exactly. And I think people are starting to figure that out now, possibly. But I want to just expand the conversation and talk broadly outside politics, now it plays into politics, with one of our great guests, Dr. Todd Rose, been on before, co-founder and president of Populous, a think tank dedicated to building a world where all people have the chance to live fulfilling lives and the thriving society. That is a, and also the author of Dark Horse. Dr. Rose, welcome back.
Hey, good to see you. Good to talk to you.
I mean, that's a heck of a that's a heck of a mandate, but I think you're out. You have to find out to also how people think, how it might be different from the polls. First off, why aren't the polls considered as accurate as they were?
Well, that's a great question. So what we're finding is that it's not the methodology of polling so much as that Americans feel a lot of social pressure to misrepresent their views. So, for example, 61% of Americans admitted to self-silencing on something that mattered to them just in the last year alone. I mean, isn't that crazy? Almost two-thirds of Americans don't feel like they can be honest with each other about their views.
It does not surprise me. I can't tell you many people say, I don't bring it up. I don't bring it up. You know, yeah, Brian, I was watching on the show the other day. I would never bring that up, you know, at the wedding over the weekend. I actually think it might even be higher. Because you ever have, once in a while, you have someone who comes out and just says, you know, I'm for this candidate or this candidate, or I'm Republican, I'm Democrat. That's actually, I think, more the exception than the rule.
That's right. And to your point about it even being higher, this is what people would admit to. And so what we did was we did the largest ever private opinion study on where people would be just outright lying about their views across 64 of the most controversial issues in society. And to your point, here's what we found. Every single demographic in the country is misrepresenting their views on multiple issues. I mean, that is just unbelievable. I mean, how does a democracy function when we don't even feel like we can be honest with each other?
I know. I mean, I feel like in a way I understand it, because the issues, if you did this polling in 2016, how people really felt, you know, especially when Trump came out in 2016, I'm going to build a wall. Mexico isn't sending us their best. This whole pronoun situation, if you're not using the right pronouns, you're intolerant. If you're white people, you have to apologize. I look at 2024 and people are saying, OK, I'm not afraid to say that I think that is ridiculous.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing a fever break, right?
Do you feel that too?
I do. And I think part of why we wanted to do this is to say, look, we've all been feeling it. You're not alone. And let's show you the real consequence of this. The fact that we are outright publicly saying things as Americans that we don't believe in private leads to policy disasters. It leads to declining trust in each other. I mean, we found this, that people who self-silenced have some of the lowest levels of social trust ever recorded in America. I mean, it is really, really problematic. But here's the good news, and I think there is good news, is when you get under the hood, past what people feel like they have to say, what do they privately think? I was blown away at just how much in common Americans actually have. Like, it's unbelievable. And even better than that, it's what we have in common. We, across all demographics, we still believe in core American values, right? We don't want communism, for example. It's hilarious. Privately, only 2% of Americans even have a favorable view of communism. Only 3% feel even remotely similar to about socialism. You know, we still believe in meritocracy. You know, all that conversation about affirmative action going away and that was unfair. There isn't a single demographic in the country, including African Americans, who actually think you should use affirmative action in college. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. I did not read that part of the study. That is so interesting.
Yeah. And so when we look at this, I look at this and say, look, if we just start being honest with each other, we are going to reveal an American public that we'll recognize, that we can be proud of, and we can start making progress. Because when we're not telling the truth, you get really bad policies. You know, when, like back in the day when people all went after the defund the police idea, like that has no support. It is incredible. Right now, publicly 18% of Americans say they support defund the police. It is 2% in private. 2%.
Right.
And so, like, as you look at this and you dig into this is a massive.
So listen to this. So I'm talking to Dr. Todd Rose right now, co-founder and president of Populous. That very question was initiated with an answer from a Democratic governor who didn't say it then, but now feels bold. Listen.
Today we have a great political argument on the Democratic side. Who is more progressive? Who's more progressive? I don't even think they know what the word means, progressive. Some people think it's progressive to say defund the police. Yes, in theory, if everybody had an education and everybody had a job, nobody would need to commit a crime. I get the theory, but it's not that simple. Defund the police are the three dumbest words ever uttered in politics.
Right. And you know what, Todd? It's easy to say that now. It would have been great to hear that 5 years ago.
That's exactly right. Wouldn't it have been great to know that Democrats privately, only 3% of Democrats privately support defunding the police?
Yeah.
Like, this is what happens. You know, we're seeing that right now. For example, in the aggregate, Americans are outright misrepresenting their views on, for example, whether they think labor unions are good for the economy. A majority publicly says yes. In private, they don't believe it.
That's so interesting.
It's like, all I'm calling for is, like, you will be surprised. Like, I think most of your listeners will feel this way. Let's take immigration. Guess what? 2/3 of Americans privately believe legal immigrants do more to help the country than hurt it. And half of the country or more says if you came here illegally, you should be deported. Both of those things are true.
Right. And that's what Trump's going on. I saw that in a myriad of polls. But same with me. I mean, there's a part of the Republican Party I don't get. They want zero immigration. And that's ridiculous. Yeah. You watch the decaying society in China and Russia and elsewhere. That's because no one wants to go there. Japan?
This is the problem, right? We need good legal immigration. And right now those are being bundled together, right? Both sides have an incentive to just call it all immigration. But right now the American public is very clear. We like legal immigration. We don't like illegal immigration.
And if you know anyone that went through immigration, it's too hard. We should find a way to get people that do it the right way in easier.
Yeah. And we're seeing that again. So it's like people that can take positions to say we're going to increase accessibility for legal immigration and make it harder for illegal immigration to happen. Similarly, there is this massive turn in America toward meritocracy. It is incredible, from college admissions to how you hire the most qualified person, the idea that you shouldn't treat some groups differently just because there were historical injustices. Every demographic has moved in that direction. And at the same time, they still value diversity. In fact, 64% of Americans privately said more diversity would be good for America. So just because you don't like DEI doesn't mean you don't value diversity.
Plus, Americans have this thing called freedom. I want to make my own choices. I don't want to be jammed down my throat or called a racist, sexist. If I'm not for DEI, but man, would I like a diverse workforce? Absolutely. Also, there's so many people who want to help. If there's people economically disadvantaged, to be able to get the education to allow them to excel. So, how about when it comes to the most controversial thing in America, abortion?
So this is one where, actually, privately, it's fairly settled. Like 63% of Americans think that it should be legal in most cases, right? There's no one thinks it should be legal all the way till the very end, that kind of thing. But it's actually like men and women agree. Even religious folks, like Catholics, publicly say they're against it, but privately they're for it. So it's one of those things where it's, you know, digging the hills and going, especially to the extreme, right, where you're saying like 6-week bans, there's just really almost no support for it.
And what about, going the distance, did you ask about the weeks that would be unacceptable?
We didn't go deep on that yet, just the general idea of legal in most cases. But let me give you something else that was a little bit of a warning sign. So the idea with the Second Amendment, right, the idea that we asked whether people believed that owning guns should be illegal, right, something as extreme as that. Now, the vast majority of Americans are like, no, that shouldn't be illegal, except for one group, millennials. So millennials, publicly, only 37% say, oh, yeah, it should be illegal. In private, it is 54%. This is the first generation that, if they were in charge, would actually consider abolishing the Second Amendment.
That's fascinating. Overall, Dr. Rose, how much do you think Donald Trump is an example of what's happening with polarization in this country? And how much do you think that his style and approach pushed partisanship and polarization?
I actually think that he's a symptom of something, not the cause. I mean, his style definitely sort of inflamed it. But, you know, one of the things we looked at that I think is the most frightening thing of all is the level of perceived unfairness in society. Because when a majority of a country thinks society is unfair, it tends to become so unstable that it's hard to function. We found, and this is no kidding, and I've never seen anything like it, 93% of Americans believe that society right now is unfair. That is unbelievable. So when you start to feel like your society isn't working, that there's obstacles in your way to opportunity, that the rules don't seem to apply to everyone, these kind of things, then you start to like get really frustrated. You start to like look for the cause of it, and we start getting at each other's throats. And when you combine that with the rise of social media, which has allowed these carnival barkers, right, these vocal fringes, to come off looking like they're speaking for a lot of people, it has really messed with us, and we have just lost our way. But I just want to come back to, again, look under the hood. We are still Americans. We still share core values. And all we have to do is find the courage to be honest with each other.
Dr. Todd Rose, where do we get more in your study?
If you go to populist.org, it's right there. And I hope you enjoy it.
All right, go get him. Todd, great to hear from you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Got it. 1-866-408-7669. When we come back, we're going to let you know what Cardinal Dolan has to say about Kamala Harris's big decision on the Al Smith dinner and so much more, including take some calls, 1-866-408-7669. Or you can call me, or you can email me, briankilmeade.com. I'll get it, be able to see it. Don't move.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
We're disappointed. We were looking forward to giving the vice president an enthusiastic welcome. And we were confident that she would find this. You know, she speaks very much about the high ideals and how it's good to get away from division and come together in unity and all. Well, that's what the Al Smith dinner is all about. We haven't given up yet. We're not used to this. We don't know how to handle it. This hasn't happened in 40 years since Walter Mondale turned down the invitation. And remember, he lost 49 out of 50 states. I don't want to say there's a direct connection there. But so we're not used to this. And we're not giving up.
So that was Cardinal Dolan. How great was that? Those comments, the sarcasm. And he's saying, I cannot believe you're not showing up. You could read the teleprompter. Someone else will write you jokes. You show up, be self-deprecating, and go have fun with President Trump. President Trump sits there. They wear white ties. I'm lucky enough to be in the dais. It's a great event. It goes to Al Smith Foundation. Different charities can apply to get this money. They made like $7 million a year. The higher-ups go there, Mike Bloomberg and on down, for great causes, a great night. And this is the one thing you see on television every year to see. The last time it was done was 2016. Pandemic wiped out 2020. Now's the time in 2024 to do it again. They're not doing it. I think it's absolutely awful. And there's a couple of theories out there. One is she doesn't want to show up at a Catholic event because she loves abortion. She loves showing up at abortion clinics, thinks it's the greatest thing ever. Everyone should have an abortion, just like that lunatic Attorney General Letitia James in New York, number one. Number two, it could be she is so afraid of trying to show a personality and be funny when she's not. There's all these stories about her having all this stress when she goes into unscripted situations, that she had the cocktail party she had to go to, would have to rehearse how she has to act at a party. Number three, and it's probably the one that's most relevant, she does not want to humanize Donald Trump. She wants to make him worse than life, a villainous Hitler-like character. And if you show up in a self-deprecating and make fun of his wealth or his ego or his hair, you are humanizing him. That's the same thing they said to people like Jimmy Fallon. Why are you playing? Why are you having fun with him? You're making him a human being. Now, people, the 70 million that voted for him, can't believe people like Howard Stern says, I can't stand anybody that voted for Donald Trump. And for that attitude that exists out there. And remember, what the press secretary said when asked, two assassination attempts at Donald Trump. When asked, don't you think your inflammatory language of saying that he's a threat to democracy is aiding and fueling a lot of this hatred for would-be assassins? And their answer was simple. Well, remember January 6th. I will say one of the biggest challenges to democracy is not trusting the election, not being transparent in the election, have an election season instead of election day, fighting back every time someone says we'd like to have ID when it comes to voting. 60%+ of the country want ID when it comes to voting. So I think that is an absolute joke. Other people, I just think that people think, well, what's the big deal? It's a big deal because if you could start kidding around about our differences through these surrogates, which are the candidates, that'll bring the temperature down on the Thanksgiving Day table. When people vehemently disagree, they know they could have fun. And SNL used to not be a partisan place. Now, when SNL comes back, did it come back this weekend? I didn't even see. It didn't, right? Was it in repeats, do you know? I think it was in repeats because I watched some of the updates. And I'm saying this stuff seems dated. But when it comes back for his 50th season, it was known to be an equal opportunity offender when it comes to politics. That's why Trump was able to get on there. That's why Bush and Gore and Sarah Palin went up there. So if you were having someone imitate Kamala Harris, you talk about her word salads, things that go in a circle, or politics of joy, have a tongue-in-cheek, make fun of it. At the same time with Donald Trump, talk about eating dogs and cats, they'd have fun. But I guarantee you, when it comes back, you know what's going to happen? Kamala Harris is going to be this women's rights and this 19th Amendment warrior. And on the other hand, you're going to have Donald Trump being portrayed as a Neanderthal. If you could start having fun with it, comedy stopped the political correctness, and comedy could end the polarization, not end it, but really minimize it. By the way, Jim Gaffigan, who I understand leans left, I don't think he's going to bring politics into it. I think he's one of the funniest comedians around. He's emceeing that night. He's a big Catholic guy. He's got six kids, big with the church. Left wing, got it, but absolutely hysterical. So that would go a long way. And he can write jokes on both sides. And he can write jokes just about parents and things like that. I'm a big fan. Maybe you aren't. BrianKilmeade.com. Write me on that.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade Show here. Thanks so much for listening. 1-866-408-7669. So glad you're here. We're going to have a busy hour coming your way. We're going to talk to Dan Sullivan at the bottom of the hour, the senator from Alaska. We'll do a simulcast with Stuart Varney at 51. And with us right now is Neil Chatterjee. He is the former chairman of the the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission under President Trump. And we're talking climate change. Well, let me update you about what's happening. We're going to talk about the two assassinations that took place. That almost took place. They were operated against Donald Trump and why he's losing faith in the investigation. He wants Florida to take over. Also talking about the latest with Hezbollah taking it on the chin from Israel. I think they have no choice. And right now we're watching some of the latest pictures. The president of the United States working his way in downtown New York into the United Nations building to give his final speech as president. It should be riveting. And they should be talking about, drum roll, please, climate change. You know he's going to be talking about that and how he made the world a better place, and he's going to find some way to take a shot at Donald Trump. Neil, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first time I'm meeting you in person, but you've been on before.
I've been on a couple times, but it's great to be in the studio.
First off, in the big picture, I never remember us talking less about alternative energy and new Green Deal type things and the greening of the economy and the vilification of fossil fuels as much as we do now in 2024. They don't even want to talk about it. The Democrats do. They used to run on it. What happened?
Well, they can't, because if Kamala Harris loses Pennsylvania, she loses the election. And natural gas and natural gas production is huge for Pennsylvania.
And burns clean. You're the environmental guy.
It's cleaner. It's safe. It's easily transportable. It is a really, really good fuel that has driven growth in the American economy.
Okay, and I'll add something to that. Why aren't we talking about electric cars, get rid of the combustion engine? Why? Because people don't want them. Some people do. That's great. Even with the incentive, they're still closing down plants with the major auto companies because it's not paying off in the back end.
They made a huge mistake politicizing EVs. Look, I kind of love the idea of getting an electric Ford F-150 Lightning. It seems like it would be a fun car to drive. But a lot of folks now, because they politicized it, they don't want to buy an EV because they feel like they're part of a political agenda. On the other side, you've got a bunch of progressives who previously bought Teslas because they wanted to demonstrate and virtue signal how clean and environmentally conscious they were. But then when they discovered that Elon Musk had conservative political views, now they don't want their Teslas anymore. It is insane. If you want to incentivize adoption of new technology, don't make it political. Huge miscalculation.
By the way, I was asked to speak at this one conference on alternative energies and electric car, and they were just, it was an energy conference. And one thing is abundantly clear, and Japan showed us, hybrid. Hybrid, when you give people a plug-in option along with a combustion engine, affordable, makes more sense. When you tell everyone go electric and then tell everyone we're not mining in America, we're not mining in Minnesota, not mining in Las Vegas, so we got to go to the rare earth, get somewhere. Guess who has rare earth? China. So don't say you're tough on China and they're a problem at the same time slaving our economy to China.
That's why we just need market-driven solutions. Look, the U.S. can be a world leader in clean energy, and we ought to. There's money to be made in clean energy. Let's let the market dictate how that plays out. Government shouldn't be trying to force it.
Well, we know when sometimes you need a nudge. It's okay.
Sure.
Need a nudge. Let's show it. Let's demonstrate to people. You put celebrities out there, famous athletes out there doing things. I got it. That's called advertising. But when you actually de-emphasize the combustion engine or oil and gas and vilify people for doing it, people get resentful. We saw that in the pandemic.
I mean, that is why you're seeing Republicans writ large and Donald Trump specifically make gains with working class voters. And I do think that energy and climate change is kind of core to that. Republicans have been able to talk about clean energy in a smart, market-driven way. Democrats are talking about it in terms that alienate these working class voters who are worried about what this might mean for their economic futures, for their jobs.
The right leader can solve this. You can do this without being polarized. And when a Republican comes up and talks about the need to go clean in a responsible way, that'll go a long way as opposed to John Kerry. You were at an event with him yesterday? Were you in an event with John Kerry?
Yes, sir.
Here's a little of what he told Axios yesterday about oil and gas.
On a letter grade scale, how is the oil industry doing on energy transition?
I can't get into letters on that. I mean, I'm not sure. Is there anything underneath Z? they're doing some things, but they are things that are not going to make the difference.
Yeah.
Some people call it greenwashing. Some people call it other things. It's just not having the impact it needs.
So he was there yesterday. This is not from your event. He was asked a question, what grade would you give the oil industry? He said, is there something below Z? What do you say?
I mean, that's outrageous. When you think about the efforts that the oil and gas industry are making in this country to not only provide for economic prosperity, for, you know, consumer benefit, but also for the environment, to attack the industry writ large, it's borderline irresponsible. And, you know, instead of condemning the industry, why not talk about what they're doing geopolitically to help our allies in Europe in the aftermath of Putin's invasion of Ukraine, what they're doing economically to create jobs here in the U.S. And, oh, by the way, because we do it cleaner and better than everyone else, U.S. exports of oil and gas actually lower global carbon emissions because we displace dirtier sources of fuel overseas. There's a positive environmental benefit to it as well. So former Senator, former Secretary Kerry, instead of attacking the oil industry, he should be trying to work with these companies who are trying to do the right thing because market pressures are compelling them to do it.
It's just so idiotic. We're not going to mine and we're not going to do nuclear. Really? Okay. So there's responsible, smaller, more compact size nuclear plants. So people are open to it, but obviously people are worried about them being weaponized, nuclear war, and it started with the atomic bomb. We understand there's a label to nuclear, but there's also a way to sell us on nuclear, which burns clean and might be effective. They tried to get rid of nuclear energy, didn't they, in Germany and throughout Europe? How'd that go after the Japan disaster?
It's been a total disaster. If you look at Germany in particular, with post the Fukushima disaster in Japan, moved away from nuclear power, became totally dependent on Russian gas, and that emboldened Vladimir Putin. I give you a lot of credit. You've been a huge proponent of nuclear power. I listen to your show all the time. Nuclear power is our single greatest form of carbon-free baseload power, 24/7 reliable power. If we're going to be serious about energy security and decarbonization, there is not a foreseeable future in which you can't rely upon nuclear power. We need to be touting nuclear, not putting regulations in place that make it hard to build.
Right. And you should start telling the American people this, there's nothing to fear. They're trying to get that through with reopening Three Mile Island, perhaps. So John Kerry was speaking at an Axios event yesterday, one besides the one you were at, for Climate Week in New York City. Here's more of what he said.
All of the things that President Biden and Kamala Harris have been trying to do are not based on ideology. They're not political. They're not labeled Democrat, Republican. It's what science, mathematics, physics, some biology and some chemistry are telling us we have to do. And we've agreed in Glasgow, in Sharm el-Sheikh, in Dubai, that we are going to do X, Y, and Z in order to win this battle.
Do you believe it's not being driven by ideology, the Inflation Reduction Act, which is really the new Green Deal?
I mean, look, this is the big thing. So the agency I previously served at, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, our job was to keep the lights on in an affordable and safe way. And what is happening is increasingly decisions that used to be made by engineers are now being made by politicians. So John Kerry's out there talking about it's all about math. But it's not about math, because the mathematicians, the engineers, the physicists are telling us we need natural gas. We need gas generation to maintain reliability and affordability in the face of this coming surge in demand for electricity. But it's politicians who are shutting down these plants before their replacements are ready to go because of political reasons, not engineering.
So you have the private market Tesla, and if you want to refuel your car or recharge your car, Tesla built their own. You know, yeah, they got some government subsidies, but they built their own charging stations. Now the government was given money to build charging stations. As of last month, they built 8. They've had that infrastructure deal for 3 years. So don't tell me this is not ideological driven. And if Joe Biden was really sincere, I'd be hammering these people. I have press conferences. I gave big contracts to private industry to build terminals. What's going on here? They also don't have infrastructure. They also don't have the internet to rural communities. Evidently, they promised to. This is the last one I want you, before we get to your ideology, John Kerry on solar.
We're making progress on batteries and on storage. We're making unbelievable progress on solar and on wind. Solar is now 90% cheaper than it was in 2009. And the price is not just competitive. It destroys the choice of doing either gas or these other efforts.
So give me an idea where we're at in the solar industry. I know we're buying the panels from China. They took manufacturing away from us. Go ahead.
Look, solar is booming. And that's one area where I agree with John Kerry on. There's huge opportunity for solar in this country. And I think the combination of solar plus storage could be revolutionary. But until we get there, we've got to maintain reliability and affordability. And there's just no foreseeable path to that without reliance on natural gas in the short term. And so I don't want to disparage solar and storage. I'm a huge believer in solar plus storage, and I think eventually we'll get there. But as a former regulator who had to keep the lights on, I can't take for granted that breakthrough is coming. So while we are waiting for the breakthrough, which I do believe will come to arrive, we've got to rely on natural gas in the short term. So taking a position like banning fracking is completely antithetical to that.
By the way, Joe, President Biden speaking right now, we'll bring you back some highlights. One of the crawls I say is we need to end the era of war that began with 9/11. Okay, that's good. So he's against war. Tell the rest of the world where they just formed an Axis powers not seen since World War II. But what do you stand for? Because here you're a Republican saying solar panels are growing and they got a bright future. You're not anti-electric cars. You're not anti-hybrid. You're saying return to free markets. Neil, from what you learned when you were on the inside, now on the outside, if you went back, how would you handle this push to responsible energy?
I would take the politics out of it. What I tell everybody is, and I don't say this to be funny or flippant, I want to make energy policy boring again. When energy policy is boring and you let the nerds sort it out, you get constructive outcomes without all of this ancillary drama. What has happened in the interim is energy policy has gotten too exciting. So politicians and celebrities and CEOs are all taking positions on complex things like resource adequacy, which used to be left to the engineers. And now they're making these decisions and they're not qualified to make these decisions. Put the nerds in charge. I'm a nerd. Put me back in charge. I'll sort all of this stuff out without the drama.
So am I too cool to do energy?
You're way too cool to do energy.
What a great spin that is. That's fantastic. So I love the way you said that, because it's easy to get behind a catchphrase, but it's just too complex to do. What can we learn from what California has pledged to do and what they're finding?
What we learn is, so California has historically always...
Goodbye gas cars by 2035.
They drive policy nationwide because it's an enormous state. And if you look back historically, every decision they've ever made has been wrong. But because it's such a big state and they have such a consumer impact, they export their policies east continually. And I will tell you, like, the California example, driven by Governor Newsom, by Senator Harris, by others, that is the wrong playbook to follow. And for those of us in the Midwest, in the Southeast, in the Mid-Atlantic, we need to do things to keep the lights on, keep energy affordable, keep it clean, safe, and reliable, but not follow that California model.
You can't keep shutting down nuclear plants. You can't keep saying, I'm not going to drill. You can't get rid of gas-powered cars. By this time, it might sound great, might get applause, but when in practicality, the greenest person does not want to pay the type of taxes they're going to have to pay because everyone is leaving. Lastly in this, so I wanted to get this Jeep with a retractable roof. I'm done with trying to store my hard top and soft top. So I had to go to a bunch of dealerships because they don't have many. In New York, unlike Florida, it's so hard to get a car. You go to these lots and they're all electric cars. They don't want to sell you. They don't allow to stock them. And they all sit. The electric Jeeps, the Wranglers, nobody wants them. The trucks, nobody wants them. They're not ready. But they're forcing the dealership, who are not rich by nature, they're making huge investments, to keep all this inventory on their lots. How long can this math work out in these anti-carbon states?
It's not sustainable. I actually, on my way over here, I had an Uber driver in an EV, and he was complaining to me that after he dropped me off here at the studio, he was going to have to go charge his car. He said it's probably an hour-long wait, and that he'd have to pay, you know, a higher cost. He says it's cheaper in the morning than to do it in the evening. He doesn't have the capacity to charge his Uber vehicle at home. The infrastructure is just not in place. It's unsustainable. So this is what happens when you don't allow the market to dictate outcomes. When government dictates outcomes, you wind up with this situation. This isn't what consumers wanted. It's forced upon them.
It's the same thing with the vaccine as happened electric cars. Even if they end up being positive, people are going to say that's a capitulation to they see Al Gore. They don't see the future or what's good for their family instead of Donald Trump, let's say, and vice versa. Neil, great conversation. Neil Chatterjee, thanks so much. If Trump asks you, will you go back?
He hasn't asked, but if he asks, of course, I'd be honored to serve my country.
I know he's listening. Back in a moment, Brian Kilmeade Show.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Innocent civilians in Gaza are also going through hell. Thousands and thousands of kills, including aid workers. Too many families dislocated, crowding in the tents, facing a dire humanitarian situation. They did not ask for this war that Hamas started. I put forward with Qatar and Egypt a ceasefire and hostage deal. It's been endorsed by the UN Security Council. Now is the time for the parties to finalize its terms.
Good idea. By the way, whatever you want to say, the Palestinians did vote Hamas as their leaders. They are more popular than the Palestinian Authority. Bad choices? Maybe. I don't know. I can't answer for Palestinians in Gaza. But I don't want one innocent person to suffer, especially children. Neither does anybody listening right now. But when a year ago, almost to the day, October 7th, you go out and massacre over 1,000 people and they die the most brutal way possible, and you take over 200 hostage and they live the most despicable conditions imaginable, then you focus as if they're all equal and saying we have to end this fighting. How you end will decide how long the ceasefire and peace will last. How does he not know that after 50 years? The worst foreign policy in the history of the country, certainly my lifetime, chronicled the Wall Street Journal. You should read it today. There's no opinion in there. Just fact will lead you to one opinion. Disaster.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Full-scale war is not in anyone's interest. Even if the situation has escalated, a diplomatic solution is still possible. In fact, it remains the only path to lasting security to allow the residents from both countries to return to their homes and the border safely. And that's what we're working tirelessly to achieve. As we look ahead, we must also address the rise of violence against innocent Palestinians on the West Bank and set the conditions for a better future, including a two-state solution where the world, where Israel enjoys security and peace and full recognition and normalized relations with all its neighbors, where Palestinians live in security, dignity, and self-determination in a state of their own.
Well, that's fine. On what planet, I'm not sure that the president's on, but Senator Dan Sullivan, watching this with me, he's on his committees of Commerce, Science, and Transportation. He, along with the other senators, met with many foreign world leaders, including the UN General Secretary, has a column out in the Wall Street Journal today about how if we have to stand up to Iran and a lot of our problems will go away. Senator, we're trying to watch the speech at the same time getting ready for this segment. Your thoughts and your takeaway.
Well, I think this is probably Biden's last major foreign policy address. And I think the most important thing Americans and our allies have to ask is America and our allies safer today than we were 4 years ago? And Brian, I think the answer is unequivocally no. Authoritarian regimes are on the march. There's war in Europe, war in the Middle East. The Chinese Communist Party is getting way more aggressive in the Taiwan Strait. They're all working together. And what does the Biden administration do? Every year they cut defense spending. Every year they put forward a budget that reduces American readiness.
And you have to add to it.
Oh, we always
you
have
add to it in the Armed Services Committee.
Every year. And so I think that's the key issue here. And then Exhibit A on their weakness, as I wrote in this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, is the one of the hallmarks of the Biden-Harris administration, appeasement of Iran. And that is such an element of chaos throughout the world. And, you know, I'll be shocked if he even says one thing about Iran, because they always avoid talking about Iran, the largest state sponsor of terrorism that's doing more for chaos in the world than almost any other power.
As you write, since Biden's been in office, under the Trump administration sanctions, Iran's oil exports in 2020 were reduced to 200,000 barrels a day. Now it's at 2.7 million, and its foreign reserves are roughly 4 billion from 122.5 billion. The Trump administration negotiated the Abraham Accords, the Middle East's first peace agreement in 26 years, which could put the region on a path to widespread peace. But the one country that's standing in the way, with the Houthi rebels, with Hezbollah and Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the militias in Iraq, is what? It's Iran.
Iran.
But and guess who is trying to assassinate our president, John Bolton, as well as Mike Pompeo?
Still.
Iran. And guess who just hacked the Trump campaign? Iran. Not a word. We're the threats. No, but it's Donald. They're comfortable. Donald Trump's a threat to democracy. This country is a threat to the world.
100%. And think about what the Trump administration did and what they essentially gave the Biden administration in terms of Iran. The Trump administration, working with Republicans in the Senate, did something that's really hard to do, and that's reestablishing deterrence. reestablishing deterrence. Trump did it by maximum pressure campaign on the oil and gas sector, like you just read the damage the Trump administration did. By the way, $4 billion in foreign reserves at the end of the Trump administration. Biden comes in, lifts the sanctions, essentially. Now they have over $100 billion in revenues. What are they using that for? To fund, train, and equip right. Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis. Trump killed Soleimani, the terrorist with American service members' blood on his hands, the Quds Force commander, and launched the Abraham Accords. Iran was on its heels. Biden comes in, reverses almost all this, and you see Iran. Deterrence has collapsed in the region, and you see the chaos that's resulted.
There's so many different places to go. First off, can you comment, please, on the rumor that we're pulling out of Iraq again? The last time we pulled out of Iraq, we got ISIS, and we had to go flying back in. Iran took a portion of Iraq and never let go.
Yeah.
Now it's political as well as territorial. We were the people that Iraqis who had pride could lean on. We leave. What makes you think anything's going to get better? And can Congress stop it? Now, some listening to me right now on the Republican side go, good. We don't want to be overseas anymore. It's not our problem. I feel differently. Do you?
Well, listen, I mean, history would repeat itself. Obama gets out of there, right? And what? Remember, he called ISIS the JV team? They end up taking over half of Iraq. This was another thing that Trump—
By the way, you know who told him that? Secretary of Defense Austin. He was General Austin at the time.
That there was
told
the
Obama,
team.
Don't worry about it. They're nothing to worry about. They're the JV team, but go ahead.
But the Trump administration, and a lot of people forget about this, Trump administration comes in and freaking crushes ISIS. I mean, that was—
With the Kurds.
Huge. Yeah, with the Kurds. So look, I mean, ultimately, as it is with every country in the world, the Iraqis are going to decide, right, whether they want the United States or not.
But they might not be able to make that decision because they got the Iranian hammer over their
head.
But
I do think a lot of people in Iraq hate the Iranians as much as we do, right? Remember, these guys are not great friends. But your point about having to come back in is a really good one. Trump did it. But I think that that's something that we got to work with the Iraqis on. I mean, that's going to be up to them ultimately, but I think it's a really important point you're raising.
So we watched a brilliant operation by the Israelis against Hezbollah. They are the premier terror organization in the world. They got a humanitarian arm, if you can call it that. They have a political arm. They got reservists. And they got a military. They went into Syria and helped save Assad. By the way, the Syrians hate him, hate them.
Yeah.
They were burying people alive, and they do not. They're clapping for the Israelis right now. What do you think their aim with your – you have a military background, Senator Dan Sullivan. Do you think it's possible that this operation will degrade Hezbollah to the point – will they be neutralized for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think Israel is doing the hard work, and I've already mentioned it, of reestablishing deterrence in the region because the Iranians funding all these terrorist groups have been on the march into Israel, right? So they are counterpunching. Brian, again, the sad thing is that they're doing it without our help. Now, I'm not saying we have to go in there kinetically with military force, but if we reimpose the Trump sanctions, which, by the way, Democrat and Republican senators fully support this. This is not some radical idea. If we reimpose these oil and gas sanctions, the ability for Iran to fund these organizations would dry up the way it did during the Trump administration. But we're not doing anything to reestablish deterrence against Iran. So Israel, in many ways, is alone. And that's just ridiculous. When Trump was in office, he stood strong with our allies and against our enemies. And these guys, Biden, Harris, are almost doing it the flip side.
And a lot of these other countries that are semi-allied with us are not a fan of the Palestinians, not a fan of Hamas, not a fan of the Hezbollah.
Not a fan of Iran.
Not a fan of Iran, obviously. So, Michael, I want you to hear what Jake Sullivan said. He's the National Security Advisor, the author of so many disasters, including the co-author of our exit from Afghanistan, Cut 23.
we've been worried that this could spill over into a broader regional conflict. And there have been moments where that worry has really spiked. It spiked in the days following October 7th. It spiked again in April when Iran launched 300 missiles and drones, and we defeated that attack. And it's spiking again now. But we have averted it in those previous spikes, and I believe that we can still find a path forward to get de-escalation.
Okay, let me ask him. At what point is he ever going to say it's in the best interest of the Israelis to neutralize Hezbollah? And that might be there might be a need to escalate in order to de-escalate.
But these guys always talk about escalation, and what it is, Brian, it's self-deterrence. And let me give you the best example. He says we've prevented this from spilling over into a broader conflict. Tell that to the Marines and sailors in the Red Sea. You know, you had Kamala
Harris. They're not in any combat zone, according to Kamala Harris.
You had Kamala Harris in the debate with President Trump saying, hey, we don't have anyone in a combat zone. No one. Tell that to the Marines and sailors taking incoming missiles and drones on U.S. Navy ships in the Red Sea. So,
or the 900 in Syria and the 2,500 in Iraq.
Right.
They're getting combat pay. Do they have to give that money back?
But let me, it's a great point, right? But let me give you just another example of this appeasement. So the Houthis are shooting missiles at U.S. Navy ships. The USS Carey, an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer, took in over 100 missiles, okay, and drones. That's a lot. We had to shoot down every single one of them. The great sailors on that warship did. But the Iranians were giving Iranian spy ships
were giving
the Houthis targeting information.
We should blow that ship right out of the water.
Unbelievable. Yes,
Senator Dan
we
Sullivan, I hope you get your way. You really make a lot of sense. Thanks
right,
so much.
Brian, great to be on the show.
All right, Senator Dan Sullivan from Alaska.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Love doing these hits every week, but as you know, we usually have a little time on the back end. I got a ton of emails. I'm going to pull them up if I can off camera. I'm waiting for Stuart to pull us in on Fox Business Network. And we also take calls, 1-866-408-7669. I got some highlights from the president's speech, but as you know, he can't really deliver a speech anymore. And he talks in a way that is, to me, detached from reality. He thinks he's been a great foreign policy president, restored American deterrence in the world and respect. Maybe in your cocktail parties, after NATO meetings and EU sessions, but not in the world. And you heard Senator Dan Sullivan here talk about the need to deter Iran. Let's listen.
Okay, now you're on with me at the moment, Brian. Did you realize that? It's 10:51. That's our time together, okay?
All right, let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. I want to talk to you about Donald Trump. He says he will attend the Al Smith charity dinner in New York next month. Kamala Harris will be the first presidential candidate to skip it since the 1980s. But, Brian, I understand that Cardinal Dolan is talking to top Democrats and trying to get them to persuade Harris to actually attend the dinner. You think she will?
Well, I'll tell you, Senator Schumer does have sway. And Senator Schumer, I sat next to him. I'm lucky enough to get on the dais for the last 5 years. So from Henry Kissinger, Maria's there every year, to people like Senator Schumer, I sat next to him and we talked about everything he thinks is extremely valuable. Plus, you know, he thinks it's impossible. Is it good to show up for the Catholic vote? Wouldn't that help? Do you know how much money they raise for Catholic, for Al Smith Foundation charities? Millions of dollars, but on a candidate year, it quadruples. Now, she's costing charities money. And listen, Stuart, you can read the prompter. All the funny people are voting for her. I'm sure one of these guys, like Chris Rock, can split off and write her a funny monologue. Chris Rock endorsed her on Oprah's show. But one of the reasons I think she's not going is she loves abortion. And she loves showing up at abortion clinics. I'm pretty sure Catholics are pro-life. Maybe she's embarrassed by that. Or maybe she just is not comfortable in a social situation and doesn't want to humanize Donald Trump like Jimmy Fallon did when he messed up his hair and treated him like a human being. He got blowback. If she has fun with him and she laughs and takes some hits humorously, maybe it'll stop. It'll humanize him. And dare I say, some people might vote for him. Maybe that's it. One of the three is it.
I think you're right, Brian. I don't think she'll appear. Donald Trump helped a mother of three, helped her pay for groceries. This was at a campaign stop in Pennsylvania. Watch this.
Here, it's going to go down a little bit. It just went down $100. We'll do that for you from the White House, all right?
Thank you.
All right, bye. Nice seeing you, everybody.
Okay, Brian, you spoke to the mother and her husband on Fox and Friends this morning. Again, watch this.
Do you feel like they're gouging you? Because we hear from the vice president that it's price gouging.
No, those are completely...
They're lies.
Yeah.
I mean, Ryan has to increase his prices when everything else goes up. You know, the fuel to get the merchandise to the store, the producers of the food, their prices are going up. It's just the natural effect.
All right, Brian, why do you think this story is getting so much attention?
Because he went into the supermarket. Something, no offense, Stuart, but when you watch on your channel or any channel and you hear people go, prices are going up, prices are going down, an arrow pointing this way. Here's a picture of milk. But imagine if you go to the store and you see the milk. Imagine if you see the counter and you say, I could visualize my counter, my supermarket, the place I go. She's paying too much. He knows she's paying too much. How do we know that? He's actually in the store comparing it. The thing about President Biden, what you want to do, excuse me, President Trump, you want to make him a detached billionaire. The problem is he's a blue-collar billionaire. He likes those places. He likes those people. And with theirs, that was $194. He gave her $100 towards that price. And he wants to show up and tell people, I understand what you're going through, by actually doing it and being there. I thought it was a great move in the state of Pennsylvania. But I also think the president missed an opportunity to talk about the elephant in the room, not necessarily in the supermarket. There is an LNG pause right now in this country. No more liquid gas. You can't frack and produce it. No more new leases because this administration's worried about their left. If you are for fracking now, Kamala Harris, Ms. Vice President, you got a job now. Show us how into fracking you are. Lift the ban. Lift the pause. And then all of a sudden we'll see some action behind her empty words that we get through surrogates.
All right, Brian, we're out of time, but thanks very much for joining us. Same story for you, Steve Hilton. We're out of time, but thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Always appreciate it. Okay.
All right. Let's go out to Ellis, listening in New York City on WABC. Hey, Ellis.
Hey, Brian, thank you for everything you do. You know, it's astounding to watch this embarrassment in chief up at the UN when he has a complete and total opportunity to end all of these wars and all of this conflict. And here he is in our own city, right? Our own city with all the world leaders. And he gets up there and talks about violence against women. And is he clueless or is this Democrat regime, are they careless? I mean, why are they allowing this to happen?
Well, I mean, first off, you got to call out Iran. They're coming up next. I want to tell you, they're the problem. You know how many people they're responsible for killing? Thousands of Americans over the last, since 1979, including, I would be lauding and high-fiving over the death of the masterminds of Hezbollah, the mastermind, the barracks attack, killing 240 Marines back in the 1980s, and all the attacks that took place in Beirut. Instead, he wants to talk about the need for peace and Palestinian two-state solution. My goodness, if you don't massacre 1,200 Israelis on October 7th, you don't have any problems in Gaza. That's how you start. And you don't let the Houthi rebels keep us out of the Red Sea. A bunch of people in sandals and moccasins who are sitting there starving their own people were able to keep the number one fleet in the world out of there and all commerce from going through there, while the Iranians sit on the side and give them the coordinates of American ships. So it shows weakness. I can't wait for him to go. He's been a terrible foreign policy president. The worst ever, with the most experience, but the worst. Thanks so much for the call. I appreciate it. Everybody wants peace. But if you have people that don't want peace, you have an opportunity. Look the other way and let your weaker allies go on fire. Well, you stand up, show strength, and let people know the bullies are going to pay a price if you stand up. We used to know that. We seem to have lost our way on that. I'll talk about that in Peekskill, New York, October 20th, BrianKilmeade.com, on stage.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest-growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here with the latest. Thanks so much for listening. We have a lot to discuss today and a lot going on. This is a UN week, and with the UN week comes world leaders. How about 140 in all coming our way? And with the UN, you know, comes a lot of traffic, a lot of ideas, and a lot of rhetoric. You know who speaks today? Well, President Biden just spoke today. That's one thing. Number two is the president of Iran's going to be speaking, at which time he's going to make America the great Satan. And we're going to look in his eyes, in a lot of the world's eyes, as the big problem. Guess who didn't call out Iran today? President Biden, when clearly they're behind almost all the problems in the Middle East and now have combined with Russia to help Russia do tremendous damage in Ukraine through their drone program and some of their weaponry. With me right now in studio is David Bahnsen, back with us, the Bahnsen Group, CIO and founder and managing partner there, author of Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life. David, welcome back.
Good to be back.
David, as much as I love foreign policy, as much as I love talking about it, and the Wall Street Journal story today with Walter Russell Mead just breaking down the 4 years of Joe Biden's ideas put in action, which have been an epic disaster, most people are talking about your expertise, and that's the economy. This is by far the number one issue.
Yeah, since a couple of years after 9/11, domestic policy has been the bigger event politically than foreign policy in our country. And that's for kind of obvious reasons. People feel kitchen table issues more than they do foreign policy. I happen to think foreign policy matters a lot. I also think, by the way, Walter Russell Mead is a national treasure. And Biden has been an abject failure in foreign policy.
I want you to hear, for example, this is where they're trying to close the gap on foreign policy and the border. That's where Trump's two major advantages are. And inflation. But the fourth one would be the abortion issue, which there will be a vulnerability. We could go through it. Not worth going through it. That's going to be her advantage with women overall as well. But she's not been pressed on anything that she stands for or whether she can answer a simple question. You could answer it. But Ian Sams was asked that question on a thought would be a light interview with CNN. With Pamela Brown, cut eight.
Harris was asked recently on the debate stage whether she thinks Americans are better off now than 4 years ago, and she didn't directly answer that question. So I'll ask you, does she think Americans are better off now or not?
Well, I think that she talked pretty openly about the mess that we inherited when President Trump left office and the economy and the crash that happened because of his total mismanagement of COVID and the way that COVID itself created global inflation numbers that were out of control. And so she thinks that the American people have made progress, but that we have to go even further. That's why she has. And
but,
so
but
when
just
it comes
follow
to
up on the question
when
again,
it comes to high prices for people, the choice in the election is also very clear. And she's going to keep talking about her plans to bring down those grocery costs while Donald Trump is going to explode them.
Now, ask the question again. Are Americans, does she think Americans are better off now than 4 years ago?
Well, I think when people are running for president, they want to see, what are you going to do for me?
Doesn't have an answer, does she?
Well, you know, what's funny is that when she came back around, to her credit, and re-asked the question because he didn't answer, that's when he got himself into the most trouble. By
the
saying,
moderator didn't do that on the debate.
No, that's true. The moderator did not. The CNN ones did in the first debate with Biden, but the ABC did not. Look, the Americans don't care about the last 4 years. They care about the next 4 years. It's a very bad answer. Politically, the spin of politics, some version of the answer of, oh, yeah, it's true. We inherited COVID in a mess and they did this and this and we've been trying to fix some things. That's probably the best spin answer he could give. But to get into the substance of it, you go say Inflation Reduction Act, people laugh because they don't believe it reduced inflation.
So do Democrats. They said it was a
ruse. That's what I'm saying. The Democrats laugh. They don't believe it. It was a green energy boondoggle. And that's a big problem for the political side of it. Substantively, it's all a disaster. But usually there's some spin. President Obama's pretty good at spinning things. And, you know, look, he inherited like right at the point of the bottom of the financial crisis. And then he did the big stimulus. They overpromised, underdelivered. And he had to spin the fact that unemployment stayed very high for a long time. All Kamala and Joe Biden can do is just say unemployment's been pretty low throughout our presidency. That's basically true. But they're going to have to own high prices.
Right. And when people – yeah, you did – you're coming out of a pandemic. I don't think you can blame the China virus on Donald Trump. You think you could do better on the fly than they did? Have at it. If you want to debate that, I don't think the American people have an appetite to debate the pandemic. But they did a bunch of spending programs. And the last one was in December. And most economists like you, especially Larry Summers on the left, said, don't do the rescue package. We don't need the rescue package.
But see, what I would do if I were them politically is point out that the rescue package was written by Donald Trump.
He wanted to do that additional stimulus. And then you could argue he wouldn't have ended up doing it. We got talked out of it. All of this stuff, though, to me, is a problem that we want to say the president saved the economy or the president ruined the economy. And it's this imperial view of the presidency that is so untrue. But the problem that Harris has is there were policies they passed that have been absolutely catastrophic.
Right. And the infrastructure bill is not yielding big infrastructure boons. They're building some projects, but they got 8 terminals built. The rural communities have not gotten the internet. No. I'd love to see where the spending is.
No, Intel got $8 billion and they laid off 15,000 employees. And by the way,
I watched that hearing. That was an abomination.
It was.
Did not answer the question about giving intelligence to China and the need to build in China, not caring about the Uyghurs and the slave labor building their chips.
No, you're right. And they can't go brag about the CHIPS Act because the fact of the matter is that it became a big woke boondoggle after the fact. They said, to get this money, it was supposedly so important that we give corporate welfare to companies to build manufacturing for semiconductors. And then the immediate thing they did is before you get the money, you're going to have adult daycare and you're going to have all these DEI requirements and so forth. They turned it into a big left-wing progressive boondoggle.
And how has it gone? Have we brought chip manufacturing back?
Well, there were some chip manufacturing already in motion. There were some companies already doing it in Phoenix, in Ohio, before CHIPS Act. So you took companies that do $20 billion a year in net income, and you're giving them taxpayer money. We call it corporate welfare.
So it's interesting to hear that relevance. So today, President Trump is going to have a major speech in Georgia. And the thing he's going to do is talk about a 15% corporate tax rate for companies who make their product in the U.S. He's going to talk about how he's going to lessen regulations. So people said that, for example, when you wanted to frack in Pennsylvania, the president got it done in 11 weeks. Now it takes 11 months. Inexpensive energy. He's going to talk about federal land if you need it. And he's also going to talk about pushing companies to come back home and charging them more, tariffing them if they're making their product overseas, even if they're an American company. How do you feel about that?
Well, I support a lower corporate tax rate for all. I do not believe in cronyism. I don't want to target rates for certain people. I want a broad, lower tax rate. And I would support the
corporate
deregulation. Yes. Oh, and personal rates too, but he's not running on that yet. The corporate tax rate reduction, energy independence, deregulation, those were the strongest parts of his first term. It's the strongest parts of what he's campaigning on now. I vehemently disagree with the idea of trying to punish countries for manufacturing
companies,
companies out of the country.
Trump plans to personally recruit foreign companies and have administration actively recruit foreign companies, telling them how great they can have it here in America and asking what they need to have it happen. So if you are desperate to bring manufacturing back to the U.S. in practicality, you have to take severe action, don't you? Well, you have to tell people, I know it's cheaper to make it in Ireland, but if you want to sell it to America, you're going to have to bring them here. How do you feel about that?
But, I mean, Brian, I'm not really on that side here because we have to be honest about the fact that we're manufacturing more than we ever have in America. We just are doing it with a lot less people because the technology has gotten a lot better.
Do you think we're making do you think we're making furniture here? Do you think
there's tons of things we're making overseas that we've been making overseas for decades because there's a comparative advantage. Cost structures are much lower to do it elsewhere.
Do you think America would be open to paying more if they're American made?
No, I do not. Well, we've been trying American made branding since Pat Buchanan in the early 1990s.
But
no, most consumers that are tight because of inflation, high groceries, high housing, they're not willing to pay more for some of their regular consumer goods. And when we really do have a mostly employed society of people who want work.
Does this science work? Does this math work for you? If you're bringing back furniture here and you're paying people American relevant wages, and then these people are making more money, the middle class is doing better, then they can afford to buy that furniture. Does that math work out for you, Dave?
Well, it's called a wage price inflation spiral. And no, I don't.
Spiral?
Well, I mean, eventually what the argument there is that people are making more, they'll spend more. If they spend more, then they need to make more, and it pushes.
And at least we'll
have
it here, and especially in light of this pager explosion.
Yeah.
Do you want China making our electronics in Vietnam?
I don't think any of it's necessary because I do really hold the free market in high regard. I really believe that a free market. And obviously, we believe since 1776 that involves a certain global activity. It was Adam Smith's genius. Countries trading with other countries is a myth. Companies trade with companies. At the end of the day, I believe we can do tons here in America. It's a very, very local patriotic view of the economy I have. But there are certain elements that a company in America can do cheaper overseas, and they ought to do that. And then the people that they sell to in America benefit. Now, the whole issue here that gets very complicated is that they will talk about national security risk, which I'm very sensitive to, and human rights issues, which I'm sensitive to. No one thinks that John Deere in Mexico, that there's some sort of national security risk or whatnot. And to go target a company
– which now, the president did yesterday.
Right. Versus the whole – I mean, how many things are made outside of the country? Then if we go, nope, we're going to make 100% of every single thing we buy is going to be made here. Because we don't want it to be cronyist. We don't want to pick on certain companies.
Right. I want people to hear this. Cut six.
John Deere tractors. I know a lot about John Deere. I love the company. But as you know, they've announced a few days ago that they're going to move a lot of their manufacturing business to Mexico. I'm just notifying John Deere right now. If you do that, we're putting a 200% tariff on everything that you want to sell into the United States. John Deere is going to, and anybody else that does this, because it's hurting our farmers, it's hurting our manufacturing. And if you do that, you're going to have a 200% tariff put on the product that you make in Mexico, right across the border. They think they're going to make product cheaper in Mexico and then sell it in for the same price as they did before, make a lot of money by getting rid of our labor and our jobs.
You don't like this.
No, but I mean, there's a big part of me that is growing so frustrated by the topic that I almost want us to just try it so that everyone can get rid of the fantasy. They can see what would happen with prices. They can see what would happen with their real life. There are a million things that we are able to do cheaper in our country than others, and there are a million things that are cheaper to be done elsewhere. And that comparative advantage is a very important hallmark of American economics.
Well, why would you move it to Mexico? It's not the weather.
Oh, obviously, it's labor.
So you want cheaper labor over in Mexico.
But you want cheaper labor for the purpose of being able to drive cheaper costs. So if people say, no, we want the workers here, and this is the thing that we've been learning for 15 years, do you think they're getting the laborers here? Because they're not going to get enough people to pass a drug test to go get those jobs. We have a cultural problem that no one wants to address. And I think when we get into economic protectionism and some of this economic nationalism, we're avoiding the really hard topic. And, you know, you mentioned my book full time. If we had a labor participation force of 68% and not 62%, if we didn't have 3.3 million 25 to 35 year old men who have left the workforce, John Deere would manufacture here. We don't have the workers to fill this need. See, that's our problem.
This whole drug, where do you get that from? There's too many young people on drug to pass a drug test?
Pot? Yeah. I don't want them running tractors if they can't pass a drug test. Yeah.
I don't know. They made pot legal here.
Yeah, but that hasn't gone very well.
Right. Listen, I wasn't for it.
Yeah.
But I just think that, you know, you can't have people drinking at work anyway, and if they're drinking at work, they're going to implode anyway. So,
but what I'm saying is not merely just the drug test issue. They've left the workforce, Brian. The labor participation force is a known
epidemic. How do you break that?
Oh, I think that it is a spiritual crisis, a cultural crisis, a moral crisis. It's not a political one. But when you are looking at some of these issues of a lack of workers, not a lack of jobs, a lack of workers, then it's going to take non-political solutions.
How do 25 to 35-year-olds sustain themselves without jobs?
It's a combination of things. I've studied it a great deal. There's a new report from Rachel Gressler at Heritage. Combination, food stamps. The biggest issue, I hate to say, is mom and dad letting them live at home longer and longer. People find
your lunch.
But then once you get on the public dime, it becomes very sustainable. It's easy. It's very hard to break off of that. And then you lose the job skills. You get out of shape, you know, in terms of what it takes professionally to go make it in a grown-up world.
Right. Yeah, that goes back to education too, because those educators are in control of that kid for 8 hours.
Yep.
And we'll see how that goes. Maybe you need something where these jobs lay open and the people are going to start pressuring the parents to get their kids off the couch.
Well, and there will hopefully be more of that, but that's one of the big issues is that there's a lack of shame. See, like when I was younger, if I had a 23-year-old, 25-year-old, 29-year-old friend who was living at mom and dad, you know, the girls didn't want to date him. Everyone would make fun of him. Like he wasn't. Now it's socially acceptable. That's a major problem. You 3.5 million people out of the workforce
right.
that otherwise would be trendline. That's a brutal statistic where, you know, myself right. as a 50-year-old man, Gen X, it was socially unacceptable to be on the public dime. And that needs to come back in our cultural fabric.
Real quick, lastly, the USMCA has been abused by China. They're coming into Mexico, building their plants under a Mexican name, yep. and they're selling to us. How do we crack down on that? It doesn't seem that hard. Why don't we crack down on that? Why Canadians and Mexicans crack down on their own situation, or do they don't mind breaking the alliance?
Yeah, I think that there is a complicated answer to that, and it wasn't helped by putting tariffs on washing machines in Canada when nobody believed that we had a crisis with Canada and aluminum, right? So they feel that they got picked on a policy, so now they're complicit.
Prior to the USMCA.
Prior to that, yeah. Well, it was kind of during. It was concurrent when all that was happening. But that is one of the big risks with tariffs, that even people who are for the protectionism of it always have acknowledged is retaliation. So you say, well, we're going to impose this tariff, then they're going to find ways to do it back and find ways to get around it and so right. forth. The same way we domestically operate within the rules and change our behavior based on what is economically rational, like with tax policy. It's Art Laffer's yeah. great point.
One's adjusting to the rules, one's breaking them. That's breaking the spirit of the rules at the very least, don't you think?
Of course, but that's the whole – but I think that that's what we're talking about, is that one person's breaking of the rules is another person's keeping of the rules. Right. These are two people at odds. With one another.
I tell Mexico, China's the enemy. If you do that, the USMCA ends, although they're such a valuable trading partner, especially now in wake of China. David Bonson, thanks so much. Great to see you.
Good to see you, Brian.
Complicated time, but your topic is the number one topic in America. Back in a moment.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Here's what Kamala Harris said this week about what we should do when the war is over. No reoccupation of Gaza, no changing of the territorial lines of Gaza, and an ability to have security in the region for all concerned in a way that we create stability. I feel like if that's what you have to say, don't say anything. Just shut up. I mean, everybody who talks about Israel these days is just so full of I mean, or just not, you know, I don't want children to die. Duh, who does? None of us want children to die. None of us want this war to go on. But it's not addressing what the problem is.
Thank you. I'm so glad you pulled that, Eric, or Allison, I'm not sure, or Christine. Who's helping out today, doing a great job, because I watched that and I meant to make a note to bring that in. It's 100. That's exactly what we've been saying. I want a ceasefire, one peace. Well, how we end and what we agree to helping Israel broker this is we'll decide how soon to they're doing it again. How could you possibly not want to guard the Philadelphia barrier that now has 10-foot tunnels there? They have tractors going in and out of tunnels that where Hamas fighters go. How could you possibly not want to have monitors on the inside to see that the aid that the Gazans are getting are actually getting the aid and not feeding the Hamas army? How could you possibly tolerate Hezbollah bombing every day? You can't.
Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
And I think the thing that you're continuing to see from the vice president is she's actually putting together detailed plans about things that can actually get our economy moving and making sure that our economy works for everybody. She's putting together detailed plans about what does it mean to support small businesses and making sure the small businesses are getting the liquidity that they need and the capital that they need to grow. And so what we're seeing from the vice president is real plans to be able to get the economy going, making sure that more people can participate in the economy. And I think that's a stark difference from what we're seeing from her opponent.
Right. That is Governor Westmore, and he's full of it. We have no idea what she's going to do. She has no economic track record. She had 32% approval rating before she got forced into this. And now she's in a dogfight with the former president of the United States, who you know, grades out ahead of her on all major issues except for abortion. With me right now is Miranda Devine, Fox News contributor, New York Post columnist, and author of the brand new book, The Big Guy, How a President and His Son Sold Out America. And I know we're going to get to the president's final speech to the United Nations as president, but I just wanted to get your take on this. Miranda, as someone who is such an astute follower of politics, are you astounded? We are now 6 weeks to the day until Election Day. No interviews, no press conferences, no details on anything.
Hi, Brian. Look, I'm not really, because I think we've seen the sort of the same apparatus, the same shady characters who covered up for Joe Biden and interfered with the 2020 election are doing exactly the same thing for Kamala Harris today. And that means the media, social media, the national security apparatus. We saw this week 741 national security chiefs write this letter backing Kamala Harris, endorsing her as the most capable, the most serious candidate to be commander-in-chief, which, as anyone knows, when they hear a single word out of her voice, out of her mouth, is just a joke. And nine of those national security chiefs are the same ones who wrote that infamous Hunter Biden letter before the 2020 election, lying and saying that the Hunter Biden laptop was Russian disinformation. This goes very deep. It is about stopping Donald Trump at any price. They do not want him to become president again, and they will stop at nothing to make sure he doesn't.
Well, do you believe it's Donald Trump? What if it was Tom Cotton? What if it was Marco Rubio, Governor DeSantis? Do you think they'd feel the same way?
Anyone else would be preferable to Donald Trump, because he was there for 4 years and they saw what he did. He created peace in the Middle East. Vladimir Putin was not invading Ukraine. ISIS was kaput. Iran was on their back feet. They were broke and they were not able to mount any incursions into Israel like they did, or get their proxies to start firing missiles at U.S. Navy boats. That's not the agenda that the blob wants, that these national security people, unaccountable, unelected people who get us into wars that the American people don't want and don't understand. Because Donald Trump just, he approached foreign policy like he approached everything from first principles, like a property developer from Queens, as he was. He's practical, he's logical, he just looks at a problem and figures out the best way to fix it. He's not beholden to the whole military industrial complex, to the CIA, to the FBI, to the Democratic power donors. And so he's an existential threat, not to democracy, not to America, but to them and their power base. And Kamala Harris is their puppet, as is her running mate, Tim Walz, who has a lot of similarities to Joe Biden when he became Obama's vice president, in that he is completely captured by China and the CCP. Like Joe Biden, when Tim Walz went to China as a young man and then had 30 trips every year afterwards, he came back absolutely enamored and singing the praises of the CCP, saying it's just marvelous how they have eradicated crime, etc., which of course you would have under a dictatorship.
There's a lot there. For example, Tim Walz went over there on his honeymoon. He brings students on his honeymoon to China, and they went back multiple times. And he says he's allowed to, you know, with the deal that they cut, if you're to believe that he's somehow compromised, you're allowed to insult China. That gives you credibility. But for the most part, you're there, you believe in their society, you're going to go to bat for their causes. And Governor Walz used to be able to defend himself, but now he's not allowed to talk. Do you realize he's done no interviews? Maybe a one, like, local? He walks away from easy questions. They don't even let him talk. So it's absolutely insane what's going on. He used to be the number one surrogate for Joe Biden. He was a better advocate for Joe Biden than Joe Biden was. Now he can't do anything? Why did you hire him? Why did you pick him if he can't? Tell me that J.D. Vance is protected. He's anything but. Tell me Mike Pence was protected. Never was.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the only thing that Tim Walz was able to do was to be sort of Kamala Harris's emotional support animal when she did her one and only interview, trying to be act like she was not a fraidy cat, which obviously she is, because every time she opens her mouth, she seems vacuous and ignorant and sort of a flippity gibbet, just not a serious person. So, it's frightening.
So the big guy's the name of your book, How a President and His Son Sold Out America. Here's Joe Biden about an hour ago.
When I came to office as president, Afghanistan had replaced Vietnam as America's longest war. I was determined to end it, and I did. It was a hard decision, but the right decision. Four American presidents had faced that decision, but I was determined not to leave it to the fifth. It was a decision accompanied by tragedy. 13 brave Americans lost their lives, along with hundreds of Afghans in a suicide bomb. I think those lost lives, I think them every day.
You do not, number one. You never even thought about it. You ignored all advice that you got. You had your Secretary of State in the Hamptons. You have not even read the after-action report put together by people that I know. And number two, he sounds like a punch-drunk fighter. And he's out there defending one of the worst decisions in American military history. Put that in perspective, Miranda.
It's disgusting, and he certainly does not think about those 13 service members. He gave a speech, his final speech, in which he was boasting that no military people had died on his watch. You know, he has never uttered their names. He has never met with their families. And in fact, he and Kamala Harris set about to traduce Donald Trump when he turned up to the anniversary this year at Arlington Cemetery at the invitation of the families, and they pretended that Donald Trump went there for a political stunt to get a photo opportunity. Not the case. And in fact, if anyone's done photo opportunities at Arlington Cemetery, it's Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Neither of them has cared about the disaster that they set in train, the needless deaths of those 13 service members and the maiming of 45 others. So this sort of post facto too late excuse is really quite disgusting. And I hope that his audience doesn't believe it, but of course they will. It's the UN. That's his favorite audience. He's always run his presidency with his eye on being admired internationally because there are so many lies told about him, and diplomats overseas, you know, are always going to be pleasant to America because America pays for everything.
Right. So the other thing I saw, Lev Parnas over the weekend apologizing to Hunter Biden.
Ugh.
He was used as Rudy Giuliani's source in Ukraine, and apologizing, says, you did nothing wrong. I trumped it up to be for all the wrong reasons to help Donald Trump and said negative things about Donald Trump. And he pretended to take on Tony Bobulinski, who knew the facts. What do you say to people like that who act like Hunter Biden did nothing wrong when it's already been exposed how much he's done? And because the deals are about to be unwound about what he's paying taxes on, he quickly pled guilty. He pled guilty to the gun charges, too. But we just are scratching the surface on everything the Biden family was involved in.
It's incredible. That documentary with Lev Parnas on is I watched it the other night. There are so many lies in it. It is really difficult to even know where to begin to start outing it and fact-checking it. Lev Parnas is just obviously just a hoodlum, and he is just swaps sides with the wind, whatever works for him. And Hunter Biden used that opportunity where he appeared in that documentary, which was obviously designed to help Joe Biden with the expectation that he would be the candidate. And Hunter Biden says to Lev Parnas, oh, so, you know, tell me about how the Department of Justice was biased against me and how they went after me unfairly. Just completely the opposite of the truth. We know that the Department of Justice absolutely obstructed the investigators in Delaware who were trying to criminally investigate Hunter Biden and his business dealings that involved his father. And every time they went down an investigative trail that led to Joe Biden, they were told, don't go there. You're not allowed to have a search warrant for a cottage on Joe Biden's estate that Hunter was living in. You're not allowed to ask witnesses about Joe Biden or to ask who the big guy is. The big guy, of course, was the code name given to Joe Biden by Hunter Biden's business partners. And we know that because they've told us. Tony Bobulinski and Devin Archer, who are coming to my book launch tonight, they have told us exactly what went on behind the scenes. And this documentary is trying to whitewash it, using Lev Parnas to sort of flip the story around and try and accuse Donald Trump of what Joe Biden was doing, which the Democrats did with great success because they managed to actually get Donald Trump impeached for Joe Biden's sins.
It's maddening to see all the facts and know that so much is not going to come out. Can you imagine, Miranda, in retrospect, you ever take a step back when they realized that crackhead Hunter dropped his laptop at a computer repair shop and forgot, and the FBI had it? Can you imagine that moment?
They were in panic, and you know, they obviously had been tipped off about it ahead of time, but by the time it was in the FBI possession, and then very quickly the FBI forensic expert ascertained that it did belong to Hunter Biden, that it was legitimate, that it hadn't been tampered with, and that it was suitable to use in a court of law as evidence. It was too late then, but what they managed to do was they couldn't wipe out the laptop, but they could then pretend that it was Russian disinformation. They could traduce all the sources, whether it be Rudy Giuliani, Bob Costello, John Paul MacIsaac, Tony Bobulinski. They just trashed their reputations. They did the same thing to the IRS whistleblowers when they came forward. And as well as trashing them in the media, they also conducted lawfare against them, like they've been doing against Donald Trump. Of course, Rudy Giuliani has been bankrupted and has several civil cases against him. John Paul MacIsaac is in fear of his life. Gary Shapley and Joe Ziegler, the IRS whistleblowers, are being retaliated against to this day by their bosses at the IRS, who were cowardly and did not protect them when they were trying to complain about what was going on in Delaware under U.S. Attorney David Weiss and the Department of Justice, who were just slow-walking, obstructing, ensuring that the statute of limitations on the most serious charges evaporated or expired before they could be charged. And it was really a tribute to them, to those whistleblowers, that Hunter Biden ended up being convicted in Delaware on gun charges back in June, and then was forced in the end to plead guilty to the tax felonies in California earlier this month, in fact, on the first day of the trial. And if Joe Biden had been the candidate, that trial in California would have been lethal to his prospects.
Yep.
Because you could see from the indictment that all the evidence coming from 2013 and 2014, even though the statute of limitations had been allowed to expire, it was going to be brought into evidence. And that included Joe Biden having fired the Ukrainian prosecutor who was investigating Burisma, which was that energy company in Ukraine that was paying Hunter $1 million a year.
So, yeah, that's all in your book. This new stuff, too. It is called The Big Guy, How a President and His Son Sold Out America. Miranda Devine, congratulations on all the work you did leading up to this and the book itself. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Brian.
You got it. Listen, when we come back, we'll find out if you need to know more.
It's Brian Kilmeade. More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
That means I should start talking now. Now it's time for More to Know, everyone. What a great way to finish. Just keep in mind, you have a chance to see me on stage again in Peekskill, New York. Go to BrianKilmeade.com, History, Liberty, and Laughs. I go over the five books for patriotic people they love, the five history books I've put out, and then the two sports books, and they go through what's happening in the news as we get. We'll probably be we're just a week and a half from Election Day. So that's when I open up to the phones. VIP opportunities open up to the audience. VIP opportunities, too, at BrianKilmeade.com. So let me tell you what's happening. First off, President Biden sits down for a live interview with The View tomorrow. That should be exciting. Always interesting. Joe Biden, who's going to be propped up by The View. Are they going to pretend they can understand what he's saying? Very interesting. I have a prediction. They're going to say how heroic he is that he stepped aside, not willing to admit that he said only God Almighty could make me step aside. I'm not going anywhere. Do you remember that, Christine?
I sure did. I sure remember that. I think this is going to be...
Is Whoopi going to remember that?
This is going to be a hard-hitting interview.
I can just imagine. Next, moms nationwide are leaving gift cards in diaper boxes, and here's why. Because they could sense that people might need a little bit of a boost. Then a Nashville mom with a two-year-old son in her local Target this month when she noticed a familiar sight. A silver clutch bag that retails for $20 misplaced on the shelf with the tag still on it. And they see that they think that they bought baby diapers instead of that purse. So they said, what if I gave gift cards to these women who are shopping for diapers that maybe they can get the purse too? Don't you love this?
I think that's very sweet.
I think it's a nationwide thing in Walmart stores especially. They found it out. It's a TikTok rage. I hate TikTok, but it's gone viral. My fear is that people are just going to start ripping them off. I think you actually go to have to go to the checkout line and give it to people.
You're not doing dances on TikTok?
Not yet. I don't think people want to see me dance. And remember my phrase. I never met a dance floor that did me any good. From Fred Eldridge. Next. More apartments on the way. A record 500,000 new apartment units are expected to be built this year, but the pipeline of new projects is slowing down, according to Axios. Yes, several major metro areas are on track to build fewer units in the coming years than they did during the COVID boom. I don't know why that is. Why suddenly are we out of houses? When did that happen? I have no idea. All of a sudden, we're out of houses. I always thought the market would say if you could build houses that people want to move into, you can build. How about affordable houses? They all don't have to be as nice as Eric's. That's the big story here, I think. Next, an Indiana judge is ruling the prison must provide transgender surgery for inmates who killed a baby. The ACLU sued the Indiana Department of Corrections last year on behalf of Jonathan Richardson, who is known as the Autumn Corleone now. I guess he's a female who was convicted of strangling an 11-month-old stepdaughter. Indiana law makes them switch genders so then he can switch prisons. This is sickening. Do you agree?
What an upstanding citizen that person is.
All right, next. Employers aren't so quick to fire. Companies aren't as quick to lay off people. The triggering these days gets laziness. Why it matters, it's good news for workers, and it's one reason that the labor market has held up better than the economists expected, because no one's getting fired. That means we lower our standards or we're too nice.
Does that mean Guy Benson can't fire me?
He will try. Now, what did he say to you yesterday?
He keeps telling me I got to go to your show.
Because he doesn't like you?
I don't know. You have to ask him.
It's a lot of fun here.
I'm
party.
Pretty
we
likable.
Drink at work and after work. Eric does.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.